Good morning, and welcome to Lynn Cannell Voice, a public affairs talk program from the KHNS Local News. I'm reporter Claire Strimple, and today we're talking about living with and working through grief, trauma, and depression. These are hard subjects because it's been a hard year. COVID-19 has inhibited our travel, economy, social lives. This stress has been punctuated by a disaster that interrupted our sense of security, destroyed roads and homes. Most acutely, it took the lives of Jenny Larson and David Simmons. Joining me today, I have three guests who take on tough subjects for a living and help the rest of us navigate through them. With me in studio today is Kelly Williamson. She's the behavioral health clinician with Lynn Cannell Counseling in Haines, and she's been on the front lines of emotional disaster relief in Haines. And then joining us by Zoom, we have two guests, John Hischer, a licensed clinical social worker with the Dahl Memorial Clinic in Skagway. John is a certified chemical dependency counselor and marriage counselor. He's certified for PTSD and other emotional trauma and facilitates a number of education programs for the school and community in Skagway. And then Liz Morantz-Falvey was a longtime grief counselor at the Haines Hospice. She's joining us from her retirement in Hawaii via Zoom. Thank you all so much for coming. Kelly, we'll start with you since you're here in the studio today. Could you talk to us a little bit about what communities and individuals are experiencing here after this disaster?
Absolutely. Good morning, everybody. I would say that we are dealing with some compounded and multi-layered traumas and disconnection from our daily lives. And I think coming on the heels of 9 months of social distancing, some kids not being able to go to school. I know in our offices, we haven't been seeing people in person. That's been challenging in and of itself. And then this disaster on top of everything else. I believe we're probably having an acute trauma reaction or acute stress reaction right now to the event that happened, the weather-related event that happened 3 weeks ago. But I don't want to dismiss that that came on top of 9 months of some pretty significant challenges that we've all been facing professionally and personally.
Yeah, where do we begin to unpack some of those feelings, and what's in the range of what people can expect?
Absolutely. One area that I did not mention is the fact that the holidays are upon us, and that's not always an easy time of year for a lot of people. I think the difficult piece right now is that people respond to trauma and grief very individually. It depends on the relationship of the person, the individual, with what they've lost. It also depends on the trauma that was associated with the loss. And really right now there is no normal, unfortunately, and that makes it very uncomfortable for professionals like Liz and John and I, because I think people are seeking a really solid answer. And unfortunately, there really isn't a normal. There's a range of things that we can talk about, I hope, this hour that people can be expecting. But I do want to emphasize that we don't need to pathologize the reaction that the majority of us are having right now to a very abnormal set of circumstances.
A good time to be gentle with ourselves.
Absolutely.
Certainly. So speaking to that, Liz, you worked for years as a grief counselor. Do you have some wisdom you could impart about the grieving process? You know, what do you first tell people who cross your threshold in that capacity? Where to begin? Oh, and we seem to not be hearing you. Let's go back to Kelly quickly.
That's fine.
While we figure out that small bit of technical difficulty. Kelly, we had one listener write in, and they wanted to know, you know, it may be okay to be okay. How do you communicate that, say, at work in a situation where you're not used to letting your guard down?
Absolutely. So one of the things that I've been trying to communicate very openly with our community through Facebook and, you know, social media and just conversations with people is that it really is okay to not be okay. And that's definitely going against the grain of what behavioral health has been so stigmatized in our just society in general for decades. And so, first of all, it's just breaking that stigma down that it really is okay to not be okay sometimes. That's the first step. The second step is exactly the question you're asking. If we accept it internally that it's okay for me to not be okay, but I may need to communicate that with someone, and is it safe to do that? And then in what way is it safe to do that? And so I would just maybe practice with a trusted friend of how can I say to someone that I'm not doing okay, especially if it's a boss or it's somebody who may be writing a performance evaluation on me or my performance may hinge on whether I'm okay or not. And I always suggest that people practice that. You can find a friend. You can find maybe a not so friend that'll just be objective with you. And I'm certainly open to providing people with some kind of like some canned scripts. And we do that a lot in behavioral health. We give people like canned statements because it doesn't feel natural at first. So if you can just practice saying the same thing over and over, an example I would give is practice with a friend. Make sure it feels like you. You don't want to put a script in your mouth that isn't you. So that's the practice piece. And then when you can have that conversation without feeling super uncomfortable about it, then you just set up a time to talk to who it is that you need to speak with. And the absolute most important piece of all this is to be honest. Be honest with yourself. Be honest with the people around you, because this is not a time to play games. It's not a time to pretend. We have to be transparent and we have to be honest. And that requires a significant amount of vulnerability. And that's really what it boils down to. People are afraid of vulnerability.
Yeah, it is. It's a big one to take on, especially when you're feeling low.
Mm-hmm. And if you're not feeling well, you're not feeling well. It's no different than if you were sick with a physical illness. And so what I try to work with people on is if you were suffering with a medical disorder right now, would you feel comfortable going to your boss and telling them that you need to go to an appointment? And they laugh and they say, well, of course I would. I said, well, then why is it any different? Well, it feels different. Why does it feel different? And we just work through that, because that's what we really, to destigmatize struggling, we've got to be able to have those open conversations. And it really isn't any different. Your body is reacting physically to a loss, and there's a physical piece to that. And your body's telling you that you're not doing okay. So if you had a heart condition, or if you had diabetes, or if you had cancer, if you had a medical condition that you were struggling with, you should feel just as comfortable to go to a boss and say, I'm going to need some time off today, or I have to go to a therapy appointment, or can I take a mental health day? And I really want people to start being able to practice that, because that honesty and transparency provides so much healing.
Yeah, I think we're getting a crash course in that this year.
Yes.
And how to work through those things. So to turn the perspective, I guess, any advice for bosses? How do you take that information?
I think it needs, you know, the most important thing that a superior or a person in authority can do when someone that is under you, that you have power over, and you need to understand there's a power differential there. Just listen, truly listen. Let the person say what they need to say. Try to put aside any judgment. If there is judgment, try to sit with that and really stick to the facts. Do you have time off that you can afford to take this time off? Because if you do, that's your right. And stick to, if there's a project deadline, if there's a, like, it's okay for the boss to say, wow, we have this really big project that needs to get done, and you not being here is not going to allow us to be able to cross the finish line. Can we talk about maybe how we can still meet a deadline we need to meet while I still am taking care of you and validating your pain, if that makes sense?
So radical flexibility.
Yes. Radical flexibility. That's a great term.
So, Liz, hopefully we have figured out our audio. Are you with us?
I'm back with you. Yes.
Oh, right. This is great. Thank you. So I want to return to that question about the grieving process. When people first crossed your threshold at the Haines Hospice, just grappling with emotions that are just huge, where do you start? What's the first thing you tell them?
I come from a little bit different perspective in that my first priority is to create a sense of space for anyone and safety. And so how I start is by just trying to let the person slow down because they see me being comfortable with whatever big feelings they have. Hopefully they know that I truly want to understand where they're coming from. I think so many times when we want to help a grieving person, we want to try to make it better for them. And a grieving person just needs to get to have their feelings validated. You can't get better until you can share what's really going on for you. So the first thing I want to do is let the person know that I know that I believe that it's okay, whatever they're feeling, whether it's mad or sad or, you know, any of the myriad emotions, crazy, all over, across the board emotions that surface when we're experiencing a big loss, especially a traumatic loss.
Oh, thank you for that. And so, you know, there are so many steps. How do you conceive of that healing process or that acknowledgement and healing process?
I mean, first of all, the process, I see the process is so not linear. And I think there's so many myths around grief, like that it happens in a linear fashion. We slowly feel better or whatever. So I view it, and I think the field in general views it as it's going to be a roller coaster ride, and to, you know, become as comfortable with that roller coaster ride as possible, and become comfortable with accepting, really letting yourself feel whatever it is you do feel. And the other thing I want to say is that when we're grieving, some really helpful tools are identifying inner resources to be really search inside. What are my resources? What has worked for me in the past? Maybe in a loss situation in the past. So inner resources that have helped you in the past, and also identifying outer resources. It's hard to be thinking of this stuff while we're grieving, but it's almost like having a little list of tools that you can refer back to can help. So let me get back to outer resources. Things that we can go to support us, whether it's a friend, whether it's hospice, whether it's a counselor, whether it's dancing, music, whatever feeds us and helps us be able to be vulnerable with our feelings, as Kelly was saying, and find that inner resource or inner strength. So IDing inner and outer resources. And when we talk about, taking advantage of our friends or family for support, I think it's really important to remember that the griever gets to notice who in their lives during the grieving process really gives us support. It might be unexpected, you know. Your best friend might not be the best person when you're around them. Do you feel like you can be vulnerable? It might not be your best friend, but identify the people who you do feel good with, and you don't have to. It's not your job to show up for people who don't make you feel good. It's time to prioritize getting to be around the people who help you be with your grief.
Mm. And you touched on something that I think is really interesting. The compassionate response, of course, is to want to help someone and make things better for them. And it can just be the wrong answer, which is so cruel to rip the rug out from under people who want to help. But what are some things as someone who cares for someone who's in a trauma situation or a grief situation or just depressed or riding that roller coaster, essentially? How do you tune into that? And what are some signs to look for that you need to be tuning in? And that's for either of you, Liz or Kelly.
Kelly, go ahead, take a turn.
I was just getting ready to say the same thing. That's funny, Liz. You know, I think I really like Liz's visual of a roller coaster. And, you know, grief is not for the faint of heart. It's just not. And if you choose to grieve with someone, you're getting on the roller coaster. I think that's what Liz is getting at. You're not asking the grieving person to get off the roller coaster to make you comfortable. You have to be willing to get on the roller coaster with the person. And not everybody does well on roller coasters. And that's okay. It's a part of this vulnerability thing. Like Liz said, you need to be able to identify the people that you feel are meeting your needs as the grieving person. And then you have to get on the roller coaster. So for those of us that are roller coaster aficionados, which I consider myself, there's not a lot of talking that goes on a roller coaster, right?
There is a lot of screaming on a roller coaster. So.
And there's a lot of white knuckling it. Uh-huh. And there's some times where you're climbing a hill. There's other times when you're going down a hill. And I think the point I'm trying to make kind of sideways is there's really nothing that anyone can say that's going to make what the grieving person is going through better. And that's super uncomfortable to have to admit. So if you don't know what to say or you're having to think of something to say, it's probably better not to say anything. A slight squeeze of the hand, a pat on the shoulder, a squeeze on the knee to acknowledge your presence. That can be more valuable than any words, especially if you're not sure what to say. And if you don't know what to say, sometimes that's okay to say too. You know what? I am so sorry you are going through this, and I have no idea what to say or how to help you, but I am here for you.
Yeah. Kelly, I really want to ditto that last piece. That's
yes.
In all the grief groups I facilitate, it comes up and it comes up and it comes up. People who are grieving, they might, you know, say, oh, I didn't like it when that person said that thing. Or and then the next person will say, oh, that really worked for me. So mm-hmm. There's nothing right or wrong about anything you're going to say. You might say something that worked in one moment when you're supporting someone, and at another moment, it will be the absolutely wrong thing to say. And I think the biggest thing is if we can get over worrying about saying the right thing, then we can show up for that person.
Yes.
And we're just blundering along, making bloopers. You know, I make bloopers all the time, and I've been doing this for 20 something years. So that way you can get your own ego or head out of the way and just show up, you know. And if you're just trying, if you come into the relationship with the sense of just really wanting to understand what the heck it's like to be that person that you're holding space for, a person picks up on that, and you might fumble or whatever, but if they're going to know when you're showing up and you don't have your own agenda and you just care.
Mm. Yes.
And I think we were just joined by John Hischer. John, can you hear us? Are you on the line?
I am. I hear you now. Sorry I'm late. I came in on bloopers and making mistakes, so I feel that was thinking it's at 11 o'clock. So
we're pleased to have you. So we were just checking in about how to show up for people who are struggling, whether that's wherever they are on the spectrum of an emotional challenge. And I know you've done a lot of your work with you know, PTSD, seasonal depression, and addiction. And I'm curious, what are some signs that we can look for to make sure our friends are okay, or maybe some signs to pick up on that maybe they're not and they need us to start holding that space?
Well, some of the things we can look for is if folks are, you know, struggling for a while, you know, when it comes to like depression or anxiety or trauma, you know, we want to see people if they're struggling for, you know, I'd say over 2 weeks or over a month or so, if they're still struggling with things, then we want to step in. But some of the things you can look for are subtle, some are not so subtle. I always think about with depression, you know, it's looking at, you know, physical signs, behavioral signs, or those kind of like psychological signs. And some physical signs that people may talk about first when it comes to depression anyway is fatigue, like unexplained aches and pains, that sort of thing. They're not sleeping too well. They just have that lack of energy. And then kind of the behavioral signs you'll see if people are struggling is they start isolating themselves a lot of times. They might start neglecting some of the responsibilities that they've had, you know, even to the point of neglecting just like basic hygiene sometimes. And then some of the psychological signs that you may see is they just have a lot of like disproportionate guilt, maybe some anger, you know, that feelings of hopelessness, you know, a lot of self-blame, and then maybe even some suicidal thoughts. So if folks are exhibiting some of those things, then we definitely want to be able to step in and kind of just kind of the trail end of what you were saying there, of just, yeah, not coming in with an agenda, but just coming in and with real concern and curiosity about how the person's doing and asking them, you know, what's going on and how you can help. So those are some, so that's why I look at physical, behavioral, and psychological signs.
Wonderful. Thanks, John. And So in Skagway, at this time of year, I feel like the community really takes on seasonal affective disorders and seasonal depression kind of head on. There have been a number of initiatives in the last few years, including some vitamin D lamps that have public access. Why is it, you know, what? Tell me about that proactive approach and why you can see this coming at this time of year, which, you know, sometimes we associate with the holidays and this pressure to be feeling lively and festive. But talk to us about how depression can sneak in there and why that's something to look out for.
Yeah, it can be pretty subtle, especially when it comes to seasonal affective disorder. You know, some people like wake up like, okay, this is, things are just getting harder and harder to do. And a lot of folks right now, they don't have a job to go to. So that can really impact their ability to kind of have a good foundation of a schedule. So it can really be sneaky like that. And some people just may find themselves just drinking a little bit more than they used to, isolating a little bit more than they used to, or overeating, or you know, those sort of things are really impactful for them. So what we've been doing here, right, the Elks has the lights there. They're accessible to anyone and they're free. And some other things we've done are the free depression screenings at the clinic. So it's free, open to anyone. We've had one. We're probably going to have another one here soon where folks can just come in. They complete what is called a PHQ-9, just a quick questionnaire. Then they have a free 30 minutes with me to talk and go over that, maybe go over some self-care plan. Maybe it is additional therapy that they need. And then they also have a time to talk with a medical provider in case medication is needed. So we've been doing that. The other big thing we've been really pushing to be proactive is we've been doing the mental health first aid, which is teaching folks how to really spot those things that we're talking about, whether it's anxiety issues, depression, psychosis, and substance abuse issues. And we've also added eating disorder issues in there. So we're training the community to really recognize these things so they can be proactive and reaching out to folks and knowing what to say, because it is hard to know what to say when we're concerned with somebody. So really some good things to do to when we're worried about somebody, if they're having even suicidal thoughts, like how to have that conversation with folks. So we're getting a lot of training out there, and the Dahl Memorial Clinic and the Skagway Traditional Council have teamed up to provide that. And so we really started pushing it ever since last March. I guess that's when the COVID-19 things all started happening. And we've done, I think, 7 or 8 different trainings right now in mental health first aid to different populations and then just community at large. So it's important for all of us to know what to look for when we're looking out for our neighbors.
Absolutely. And Kelly, could you touch on, those are some of the resources that are available in Skagway. And if you check out the website after this program, we'll also have links to some of those resources. So you can stay tuned for that. at the end of the hour online at khns.org. Kelly, could you talk about some of the offerings that are available in Haines and Cluckwan this year?
Absolutely. So we, Lincoln Out Counseling Services, is part of Search Behavioral Health, and we have the same intake process, similar to what John was mentioning. You can call our front office at any time. We can do screenings. We can do a consultation appointment where, you know, 30 minutes with a therapist just to kind of get a high-level overview of what you may be struggling with. You know, not all people need to be in a therapeutic relationship with a counselor. That's just the truth. You know, life struggles can be navigated without necessarily needing to be in counseling. And sometimes it's important for someone just to hear that, you know, that what you're struggling with is on a spectrum. And, you know, I wouldn't recommend counseling until you're maybe at this level of this disorder that you're struggling with, but please come back. We have hospice, which is an amazing resource. We have a lot of AA self-help groups that people can get involved in. Our medical clinic uses the PHQ-9 as well, like John was mentioning, to screen for depression, I think, almost at every appointment. And so maybe just opening a dialogue with your medical provider. You don't have to come in through the door from the counseling perspective. You can come from the medical perspective. We have a very close relationship with our medical providers. One of our clinicians practices out at Cluckwan on Fridays. And so we've been just building up to where the Cluckwan community knows that my clinician is out there on Fridays. And so people don't have to worry about trying to get into town. Just call our office, let us know, and we will make sure that we provide that service.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. Mm-hmm. And so, Liz, I'd love to turn to you for a moment and talk about how grief changes in a traumatic event, or I guess you're the expert. So if it changes, or how it changes in a traumatic event, in this part of the world, in the Upper Lynn Canal and remote communities, we're confronted often with disasters and trauma, and how might that change or not change the experience of grief, and how might you handle those situations differently?
Yeah. When we have unexpected loss and the ground is pulled out from under us, and in Haines' case, that's kind of literal in a way, you know, there's a surreal quality juxtaposed with a too real quality, and that combination, and that's what we associate with trauma, that combination of surreal and too real. I'd like to speak to that from trauma from the point of being a really tricky loss to navigate. And I think sometimes the feelings are so weird because of this too real, surreal thing that we can think we're going crazy. And I want to try to depathologize this. We can actually take on symptoms, and it doesn't mean we're crazy. Our body can take on symptoms. I kind of want to normalize grief that is connected to trauma. The feelings, you can feel like so ungrounded that you don't want to live anymore. And it doesn't mean, you know, I want to reiterate what Kelly said. You don't necessarily, this doesn't mean, oh, I'm going crazy. This is like a really normal response to your situation. And so, allowing yourself to be okay with those big feelings. Again, Kelly said that really well earlier. Is really, really important in the healing journey, because if you're sort of freaked out that what you're feeling isn't okay, it's going to be hard for you to let yourself feel what you're feeling. Yeah, sudden loss is trickier to navigate. And, you know, it used to be considered, clinically that, you know, if you didn't accept the loss after so much time, then you need help. But I think the field of grief and loss is maturing, and I appreciate it's maturing to understand that we're all different. Some of us, whether for whatever reasons, are going to need more time to be in that place of accepting a death, you know, or that some of us don't even begin to grieve for over a year. We think, oh, you grieve for a year and then you're over it. And yet for some of us, when we don't have enough resources, inner or outer, to cope with, to heal, to journey through a loss, we can shove it for a year and not start grieving for until year two. And just to create a bigger framework to accept that this journey is really can look a lot of different ways is, I think, really important.
That's so important, Liz. This is Kelly. I think what I've been hearing across our community being here on the ground is this fear of, you know, I've got PTSD. And I really want to dispel that grief, like Liz just said, grief is normal. Grief is the reaction that our body and our spirit and our mind has to losing something that we cared about. That's a very flat, simple definition of just what grief is. Grief is normal. And some of the physical symptoms of grief can feel destabilizing. And I think that's where I just originally, like, it's okay to not be okay. That's really what I'm talking about, that grief in and of itself is a very normal experience. The way that it was packaged in our town was extremely abnormal. And I really like how Liz just said the surreal aspect and the too real aspect. That's just a beautiful way to think about that. And so we're all navigating this area in our minds and our bodies where it doesn't seem even possible, but we're so painfully aware that it actually did happen. And so I love that the field of grief and loss has grown, normalizing the discussion of that, and then not feeling hurried, not feeling rushed. We live in a society where a lot of us are used to instant gratification, instant healing, instant just give me what I need right now and I'm going to move on. And unfortunately, this is an experience in life, or fortunately, whichever way you choose to look at it, that cannot be rushed. And like Liz said, your body is going to do what it's capable of doing. Your brain is going to do what it's capable of doing. And sometimes we get numb because we're just not ready to go there yet. And so, but you will have to experience the loss. And so I just want people to know PTSD does not happen 3 weeks after an event. Clinically, PTSD can't be diagnosed until 6 months after the event. And again, that's loose, right? But technically, from a clinical perspective, so the reaction that people are having right now is an acute stress reaction to a very traumatic event. And it was a sustained event. There was one large event, but we also were experiencing days and days and days of rain and uncertainty. And so it was just this really complicated sustained fear reaction. And like I just said, it's only been 3 weeks. And some of us are just now feeling like, oh, I don't feel threatened right now. But there are others that do still feel threatened. People whose homes can't go back to, things like that. So I agree with Liz. We need to depathologize a normal reaction, even though it feels very uncomfortable.
You said something in the Legion Hall, probably within the first 48 hours of disaster, that really stuck with me. You told evacuees, there's no shame in anything you're feeling right now. Can you elaborate on that? I feel like this is kind of what we're talking about when we talk about.
Yeah. I have learned about trauma and grief, but I've also experienced trauma and grief myself. And I think that statement, a lot of people have come to me about that statement. And I think that statement came from my own trauma. And I realized in that moment that that's probably what I needed to hear 20-something years ago. And it's just interesting to me that that's what came out of my mouth. And I mean it clinically, but I also realized that in that moment, there was so much shame that I needed so many people, and I couldn't even voice what it was that I needed. And so I mean that. There is no shame in asking. These people didn't have clothes. They were wet. They needed a shower. They needed food. I mean, we were just talking about basic human experiences, and then the knowledge that to come in so vulnerable and you didn't even know if you even had a clean pair of underpants to put on to sleep in. I mean, that was just so humbling to me to be on the front line of people that had to be, you know, rescued by boat. They had to wade through water. Didn't know if they were going to go home or not. Some people had to leave their pets. I mean, it was just a very, and so the statement of no shame was just, I was hoping to just normalize, we are here and there's going to be no judgment here for whatever it is you may need to ask for. And please feel comfortable asking for whatever it is you need right now.
Thank you so much for sharing that and your personal experience. So we have a question from a listener.
Sure.
For any of you who want to take this on, they'd like to know, how do you explain your grief to children, or should you shield them from it? Is that necessary?
Well, I can I can jump in there and mention that when I've talked to families who've experienced a sudden loss or even trauma, one of the best things is to really focus on having an open dialogue with the child and leave a lot of rooms for questions and really validate whatever feelings they have, and to really focus on making sure that they feel heard and that they feel safe. I'm sorry, I'm having a hard time hearing you right now. There's an echo to the thing, but I think that's the thing to really focus on with communicating with kids, is giving them full array of time to talk about their feelings and to really give them reassurance that they're going to be okay.
And John, let me jump in here just to say, if you're experiencing an echo, if you have a radio on in the background, you need to turn that off or turn it down. And then and also if you're on speakerphone, sometimes that can cause an echo. So sorry about that. Thanks.
That's okay. Yeah, sorry.
I agree with John. The other thing, too, is that children are looking to adults. We all need to recognize Mr. Rogers. I'm a huge Mr. Rogers fan, a child of the 70s, right? One of the things that he said when his mother taught him when he was a very young boy is that when something scary is going on or something traumatic is happening around you, as a child, you should look for the helpers. And that just says, it really stood out to me during this event. There were so many helpers. But in a child's view, an adult is the helper. Whether you're grieving, whether you're traumatized, you are the helper, because children see the world through our eyes. And so being honest with your child about your feelings, it's showing them that it's okay to have big feelings, and mm-hmm. that you will be able to come back to a safe place. And a child learns distress tolerance by watching a parent be able to share openly what their emotions are, but also showing the other side of that. And so I think a lot of parents are afraid that big emotion might damage their child. It will be painful for your child to watch, but it's teaching them that life is full of good and bad, and that if the big people in my life can recover, so can I.
Wow. And Kelly, what you said there is really powerful. If I'm hearing you correctly, you're saying your vulnerability in this moment can teach your child strength.
Absolutely. Yeah. And resilience.
Yeah. Liz, did you want to jump in here?
Beautifully said, Kelly. Yep.
Thank you.
And anything
kids, kids pick up. They're very, very smart, mm-hmm. you know, and they know. And that's a terrible feeling, to feel like your parent is keeping a secret from you. They're having feelings. You're picking up that they're not okay, but they're trying to act like that they're okay. Mm-hmm. That's really mm-hmm. actually hard on a child. And what Kelly said is spot on, right? That a kid's is relieved when they can see that their mom or dad can cry, and yet then still say, you know, I'm crying, but it's okay, and I'm here for you. And they and the kid can feel their honesty and their presence, and that they really still are there for the child.
Mm. Mm. Thank you for sharing that, you guys. So we have another listener question, and this one's a really interesting one, speaking to kind of the broader community anxiety. And they want to know, how do you let go of stress and anxiety surrounding weather? Because we just went through it.
That's a tough one. I've been doing a lot of just reading myself about that. So I'm a native Floridian, and we moved here 11 years ago. And, you know, in Florida, you know when the rainy season is coming, right? And you can track hurricanes and you see those things and you have your little go kit. And so this has just been a different perspective for me because I've never really lived in a community or in an environment or a climate, excuse me, where something like super unexpected, it seemed to me in the moment. What I read is that really what's happened is that the world is really no more dangerous to us now than it was before it happened. What happened is that we had an illusion of safety. And I don't mean to say that as that was a false illusion. It was just a belief that we all held based on what our experiences in this environment have been, right? And so I think the way to start choosing to let go of it, number one, like Liz said, we have to allow that real feeling to be acknowledged. I don't feel safe now when I hear the rain or I see, except like we can't just ignore that. But what we don't want to do is grab it and turn that into our new normal. Because if you turn that into your new normal, you're accepting that fear to be your new baseline. And that's not a healthy way to live. As John said, once you grab onto that, you know, that's when some of the unhealthy coping mechanisms will come in, because we're not meant to live in a state of constant depression or anxiety. Our bodies will start chronic pain, substance issues, all those kinds of things. So number one, allow the feeling to come. You have to acknowledge it. It's okay if that's how you feel now. But coming up with a statement that you can say to yourself, and that's the statement that helped me, was I wrote it down even to bring in here. The world is actually no more dangerous than it was before. And that may not be helpful to the caller or to other people, but that's just an example of a cognitive shift. It's called reframing. We can choose to reframe our circumstance to take us to a more healthy place in our minds, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that's fascinating.
Right. And yes, it's kind of, I've had clients say to me, well, isn't that just, you know, like lying to yourself? I'm like, well, yeah, kind of. But what you're saying to me is you're not feeling good where you are over here. And the thought process is what's keeping you in that bad place. So let's try to think of some different thoughts. And you do have to practice that. Anybody else? That was the first thing I thought of, John or Liz.
Yeah, and I think that what Kelly was saying, that, you know, accepting your emotions is really the important first step to building resilience. Mm-hmm. And, you know, just I think by the simple act of noticing and naming them without judgment at all can be the quickest way to just at least not gonna make us feel 100% better, but just makes us feel a little calmer. Mm-hmm. And then you actually give yourself a chance to be able to do a rational, compassionate reframe of that feeling. So yeah, just accepting your emotions and labeling them is the first step.
Great. And so, Sean, as we mentioned in your bio before, you do have experience with PTSD, and Kelly just shared with us that that's something that's not clinically diagnosed until later. But could you talk to us about PTSD in this context, or what that might look like, and not just for the Haines disaster, but also for, you know, the ongoing economic stress in Skagway? This year has been hard.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I like to, you know, when I explain PTSD, one of the things that I think of is kind of hitting on what Liz and Kelly were talking about. It's a normal reaction to an abnormal situation, right? Like it's a physiological as well as a psychological issue. So the brain does play a big impact in this. And if I was seeing you right now, I could show you my hand. I'm making a fist, and my thumb is inside my fist, and the thumb right there is the amygdala, which is the fight or flight, freeze or appease part of our brain. And that's what's really lit up, and people can kind of get stuck there when it comes to post-traumatic stress disorder. And right now in Skagway, I can speak to this a little bit. There's just so much distressing uncertainty economically here. Since last year, I guess February, March, that people have kind of gotten stuck in there. Some folks have. And so kind of stuck in that trauma brain. Mm-hmm. Where there's just hard to, it just freezes them, and it's hard for it to make decisions. They feel on edge all the time. They have this excessive guilt, like they should have seen the pandemic coming. You know, they have these kind of unhealthy thoughts about themselves around that, and really hard on themselves. And seen some increase in substance use issues, just trying to numb out from that feeling of constant anxiety with it. So that's really. Here the trauma, you know, different than Haynes, but the trauma here is really prolonged with that anxiety financially.
Thank you for that. And Kelly, you look like you may have something to add.
I did. I was just going to say with post-traumatic stress disorder, I think it's really important. John touched on it. People need to understand that our brains are wired for one thing, and our brains are wired for survival. And what has happened, this prolonged, like John was mentioning, economic stress, this event, this weather-related event that happened, is that it triggered in our brains, out of our control, our survival instinct. And so when that survival instinct gets triggered, our brain and our body goes into an automatic response that's either I got to fight this, I've got to run away from it, or I've got to freeze and pretend until it's over. And so until we can get out of that response, there's not a whole lot more we can do. And that's where the comfort and the making sure your basic needs are met and those kinds of things. Because when people get stuck in fight, flight, or freeze, that's where PTSD comes from. And so, and it has a host of symptoms. There's 7 different criteria that have to be met. So it's not just a simple, I was exposed to something. There's a myriad of symptoms, and a licensed clinician like myself and my clinicians, John at Dahl Memorial, are qualified to diagnose that. But again, it's a stuck in the fight, flight, or freeze mode of our brain. And so those are what some of those acknowledging feelings, relaxation, meditation, it helps calm or decrease the inflammation in the amygdala. That's just the physical scientific explanation.
Well, thank you for sharing mm-hmm. that. And so we have another listener question, and I think this might be a good one for you, Liz. This person writes, I understand the idea of it's okay not to be okay, and I agree with that. But what about the people who feel okay? Is it also okay to be okay when so many around us are traumatized and grieving? I'd like to hear some assurance for people who are able to move ahead in a positive way with a less intense grieving period. Great question. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for that question. Yes, and there's going to be that almost like survivor's guilt kind of thing. And to notice it, you know, I'm experiencing it because here I am in Hawaii and you know, I'm looking out at a blue sky and I'm going to get to go swim in the ocean, you know, and is it okay for me to feel okay? And I have to work around that. I, you know, my little inner critic wants to beat myself up for feeling okay. But, you know, the more we are feeling okay, the better we can show up for other people. So it's great to feel okay. And then if we're clear in our own mind, you know, then we can show up for other people. Yeah, you're not, you, whatever you're feeling is your feeling. There's no right or wrong feeling. So you might feel like it's okay to feel lucky that it wasn't your mm-hmm. house. It's okay to feel relieved that it wasn't your child, for mm-hmm. sure, for sure.
I agree. Yeah,
Kelly's nodding over here.
I agree. That's the community aspect. And we are doing this together. And I appreciate Liz's vulnerability in stating that, you know, she's in a place where she's not even, you know, she's not physically here, but she's experiencing some emotional reaction as well. And I think just to let everyone know that's listening is those of us that are not okay in our community are depending on those of you that are okay. And that's really important for us to understand from a community perspective. It doesn't mean that we expect more, that you're going to do more. You don't have to step up and do anything more, but just that collective experience of we're not all falling apart is somewhat relieving to know that things are going to go on, because you're giving hope to people watching, because they might not feel okay, but they see someone who is, and there's some hope in that for the grieving person.
Right. Thank you. Thank you so much, you guys. And it looks like we might have another question over here. All right. We have another listener question here. And this speaks to your comment about the community, and there's this whole body experiencing this. When everyone you know is feeling equally depleted and maybe short-tempered, how do you move forward together and help each other out? So maybe just deepening that conversation, because there is a collective aspect to this in Haines and Skagway, both with the weather disaster and this year of this really trying year.
Absolutely. There's this really interesting concept, if anyone would like to research it, called Maslow's Hierarchy of Needs. M-A-S-L-O-W is Abraham Maslow. And he created this pyramid, kind of like the food pyramid that we grew up learning about. And I think it's really important for us to understand when we responded, and this applies to Skagway as well, because there was a response with CARES Act money and all those things to their economic crisis. When we responded to people's physical needs, that is at the very bottom of the pyramid. So I feel like we're kind of moving to the next rung, so to speak, in the pyramid. And the next rung is comfort and rest. And what we need to offer each other is comfort. And that may not mean, you know, a comfortable bed to sleep in or those, but just literally it's about kindness. It's about some grace for people's short-temperedness. I know I've had to apologize to several people on my staff in the last 3 weeks about snapping at them. And it hurt me that I heard it come out of my mouth, because I try so hard to be compassionate and empathetic, but we were all exhausted. And so we've spent a significant amount of time with each other as staff, like saying, I am so sorry that I reacted the way I did. Will you please forgive me? That's what I mean by comfort. So really, to move forward collectively as we're all depleted is to be kind, to offer comfort, and to rest. We don't have to be going 24/7. We can rest. In fact, we need to rest. So that's we can work towards the top of that pyramid, which is the actual therapy piece. What are we going to learn from this? We're not there yet. We're still in the let's take care of each other and ourselves.
Yeah, I agree. That's the thing, is to give each other a lot of grace, give ourselves a lot of grace. Mm-hmm. I think that's the one thing that I've seen here is that COVID fatigue sort of thing, where people are maybe a little short-tempered with each other, or they're really hard on themselves. They think they should be at their 100% best right now. And that's where just giving ourselves some grace around, like, no, we don't have to be at our 100% best right now. There's a lot of things going on. It's been a long year. So being kind to ourselves and other people, and like Kelly said, like looking out for our neighbors and seeing what type of just basic things they may need, or just that word of kindness. You know, just getting cards from people has been pretty great, you know, this last few weeks. Just those Christmas cards has been nice. So I think that's just give ourselves some grace, give our neighbors the grace, and really look out for those needs for them.
Absolutely. And so speaking of grace and comfort, we're in a time of year where those are kind of part of the values that we talk about during the winter holidays. But those can also be really hard times for people who are grieving and feeling low. Liz, do you have special ways that you talk about the holidays or that portion of the year with people who are experiencing grief?
Yeah, probably the first thing is to do everything you can to cut yourself some slack. Mm-hmm. around. It's not going to look like it did in other years, you know, that holiday pressure. And to really give yourself, cut yourself some slack, you know, and it could be even deciding, I mean, it's Christmas Eve tonight, but so this might have been more appropriate a couple weeks ago, but deciding not to do the exact same thing you always do, and maybe think of something totally goofy or different, or anyway, it can look different, and that's totally okay. And that it's, you know, just again, that piece that both Kelly and John spoke to about self-compassion, you know, it's being okay with it not being like you want it to be, you know, that it's not your responsibility to try to make it be better or normal.
And for those of us who, you know, we are in Christmas Eve right now and we're heading into Christmas and the new year, for people who have been trying to maybe put on a brave face or do the holidays like they usually do, what are ways that you can inject a little bit of that grace period or that self-forgiveness into plans that you may have already made with family and friends?
I think it's okay to back out. I mean, that's that vulnerability to say, you know what, I thought I was going to be able to do this post-Christmas dinner get together, and I'm just not going to be able to this. I'm sorry. And that willingness, because that's where the self-compassion comes from. You know, don't drive yourself to the point. And the helpers have a real problem with this because they feel like that's their role. But being able to be aware of it and just say, I'm gonna have to beg out on that, or I thought I was gonna be able to do this, but now I realize I'm not gonna be able to. Mm-hmm. The other thing that you could do is you can do something to acknowledge the loss. So some people put a special ornament on the tree. The family may go together and pick an ornament that is going to represent the loss. That's okay to do. I know the first year after my traumatic loss, we actually sat the table with his space. And there was a plate and there was the whole setting and the tableware. And it was hard to do. And it was hard to sit there with his space empty. But the reality is that we knew his space was empty. And so there was some comfort in that, if that makes sense. So do something to acknowledge it, and you don't have to pretend that it's not there, because you know the loss is there. There's no way to really deny that. So,
you guys, thank you so much for sharing these thoughts, these tactics. Does anyone have a final thought? We're getting close to the top of the hour, but before we go, does anyone have anything else that they want to get in there before?
Yeah, I just wanted to encourage everyone to look out for each other, look out for yourselves, and to reach out to, you know, whether it's Lynn Canal Counseling or the Dahl Memorial Clinic or Hospice of Haines, if they're struggling, or reach out to somebody, you know, if you don't want to talk to anybody from those organizations, just figure out who that person is that you would talk to if you're struggling. You know, we're all in it together, and so it's, you know, I think it's, you know, what Kelly said about being vulnerable and reaching out for help. This is the time when we do it. This is why we live in communities together, mm-hmm. To help ourselves through these type of times. Just please reach out.
Absolutely. And I'll provide some resources. There's a lot of online resources now. People don't have to go into a therapy office these days. There's all kinds of online. There's texting support. I'll provide you with a list of, because the menu needs to be diverse so people can get the needs met in the way that fits for them.
Great. And we will have those online in a link that we'll be putting up right after this show. Thank you so much to our guests, Kelly Williamson, John Hischer, Liz Morantz-Falvey. Thank you. Thank you for guiding us through this time. You've been listening to Lynn Canal Voice, a public affairs talk show from the KHNS Local News. Thank you for joining us and happy holidays.
Thank you, Claire.
Thank you.
Thank you.